Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Super happy today. Super happy today. We got two great guests. It's Advent. We're on our way to Christmas. And I listened to those Supreme Court arguments today, and I'm not shy about it. I don't hide it from anybody. 100% pro-life, anti-abortion. Use whatever word you want. I don't care. I thought the arguments were brilliant. I thought they went very well. I'd have no idea what the court will decide, but it made me feel good to hear those arguments at the highest levels of our government being made in favor of, respecting and protecting the lives of our fellow human beings, just little teeny tiny babies. So second hour, Dr. George Delgado will be here. He's the medical director of the Culture of Life Family Services, a family medical practice here in San Diego, and one of the great pro-life doctors in the United States. And we'll talk to him about that. So get your questions ready. And as I said, we're approaching Christmas and a beautiful new book out from the Augustine Institute and the Ignatius Press. It's such a good book. It took two media companies to bring it out together. It's called The True Meaning of Christmas, The Birth of Jesus and the Origins of the Season. Its author is Dr. Michael Barber, a biblical scholar. Dr. Barber, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, congratulations on the new book. It really is a beautiful book.
Thank you. We worked really hard on it. I'm very grateful for the people at Augustine Institute and Ignatius Press putting out there. I really believe that this is a critical Christmas in many ways for the church. A lot of people have been away because of COVID and the restrictions around COVID, and I'm hoping that people come back to church this Christmas. And so that was one of the main reasons I wanted to get the book out this year. But I've been wanting to do a more scholarly book on the infancy narratives, but I felt like this was the year to really put this thing out. So
I think it was a great
Christmas
choice.
Great Christmas all year for me.
Yeah, so much scholarship in here, and your great understanding of and years of study of Scripture is obvious here, but also a capturing of the beauty of Christmas, the special kind of charity we have in our hearts at Christmas, what Christmas means, which is greatly diminished, I think, in many ways. But you capture that in the book. It's a really joyful read.
I don't think it hasn't gone away. No one talks about Labor Day magic that I'm aware of. I don't think that.
Yeah.
There aren't too many songs about Memorial Day or even Independence Day or New Year's. You might be able to name a couple of songs off the top of your head, but
right.
Christmas is very different, right? Yeah, Christmas magic, everybody has heard of that. And Christmas has its own genre of music now,
yeah,
right? So there's something that keeps drawing our culture back to Christmas. And of course, there are many silly Christmas songs, but the best ones are the ones that endure, are the ones that really tap into our deepest longings. And so many of the Christmas songs that we hear on the radio are about, for example, dreaming, right? I'll be home at Christmas if only in my dreams, or
right,
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. Why do people have these associations with Christmas? Why do these things come up at Christmas time? I think it's because what is at the heart of Christmas, the coming of Christ, I think that right at the heart of Christmas, we have a message that speaks to people and really reaches into the depth of the person, of the human person. So this is a really powerful time of year. And even if there are people who don't share our Christian faith, it seems to me, secular people will call it the spirit of Christmas or something like that. But I don't think it's just that. There's a true message. That is that God loves us so much that he gave his only beloved son to be born into this world and to come to us in the flesh so that we could be saved. And that's a message that I think resonates for all people.
It does indeed. And the obscuring of it is the mistake, because, trying to make it, I guess, in a sense, more of a just a common kind of, like you said, spirit of Christmas, common message. It doesn't have that divine element of this is an expression of God's love for us. That's why we are so joyful and light at this time of year.
Right. And people will look at examples from literature as sort of examples of how Christmas can be just not Christian. You have people talk about the secular Christmas or something like that. And I think they even misconstrue those sources that they're drawing from. For example, Charles Dickens, people will often watch the an adaptation of A Christmas Carol. But if you go back and you actually read the book, there's no question in Dickens' book about why Christmas is so important. It's because of, as Fred explains to his Uncle Scrooge, it's because of its sacred name. It's sacred because you have Christ right there in the middle of the name. And at the end of the book, you never see this in movies or plays or musical productions based on Christmas Carol. At the end of the book, before Scrooge goes to Tiny Tim's house, right, what does he do? He goes to church.
So I had missed that completely. I never saw anybody point that out, and I was so happy you did. When I saw that in the book, I thought that's what Dickens was communicating, was that Scrooge had not just changed his heart. He's not just like like the Grinch. His heart was three sizes too small, but Scrooge had an encounter that returned him to the true joy of the season, which is the person of Jesus.
Right. And so if you read the very beginning of the book, Scrooge is described as a hardened sinner.
Yeah.
Right. So the story of the book is really about the conversion of a sinner.
Yeah.
I could say a lot more. People could pick up the book. But the whole argument of the book is basically, if you want to really enter into the homecoming of Christmas, I'll be home if only in my dreams. If we really want to enter into that homecoming, we have to recognize that Christmas's home is found in the story of Jesus's birth as we read about it in the Bible. And the more we understand that story, I think the more we can really enter into the joy of Christmas. The problem is there's so much unreliable information out there about Christmas.
Yes.
And so in some ways, I'm trying to set the record straight in the book, not just about the biblical stories, which is really the heart of it, but about other things as well. Santa Claus and the 12 days of Christmas and what is all that about and other things. So I think there's a lot that people think they know, but they don't actually know.
Yeah, this is one to just keep around and read every Advent when the season comes around again. The True Meaning of Christmas, the Birth of Jesus and the Origins of the Season. It's by Dr. Michael Barber, our guest for this hour. And as Dr. Barber was saying, so much is covered in here. And it's not a big academic book. I mean, it's very accessible and readable, but so much covered in there about where Christmas came from, how we ended up with it, and how it ended up to have its particular features that it has today. I was saying to you, Dr. Barber, I'm going to give a copy of it to my parents. And I think any kid who's got, a pair of Christian parents, or maybe one, and thinking, what am I going to get them for Christmas? They have all the Cuisinarts. They have get them a copy of this book. They'll love it. They'll love reading about the origins of Christmas and getting the truth about it. Our number again, 888-318-784. If you want to talk about the true meaning of Christmas with Dr. Michael Barber, 888-318-7884. We welcome your call. All right. So you said the name has, Fred from Dickens says it's the sacred name of the day that tells us why it's a joyful day. But it's not just the name Christ, it's Christmas. So what about the second half of that word?
Right, that's really important. I have a friend who's a non-Catholic Christian scholar. And a few years ago, he posted this on his Facebook page. He said, "It never ceases to amaze me how many of my Protestant friends insist that it would be wrong to remove Christ from Christmas while also ignoring the Mass in Christmas."
Right. Yeah.
And there's something to that, right? The word Christ's Mass, Christmas, is really based on this idea of Christ's Mass. And this is not just like a clever linguistic trick or something here. If you read the story of Jesus's birth in the Gospels, you see that it's showing us, at least in the Gospel of Luke, you see that it's showing us that Jesus's birth does have a Eucharistic meaning. The problem is that meaning is often obscured because of really bad translations of the Bible. So in Luke 2:7, it says that they laid him in a manger because there was no room for him in the inn. Okay. Now, what is going on there? I think when people hear that, they imagine there's like a no vacancy sign in Hotel Bethlehem, you know?
Yeah.
What's going on? Well, there isn't a Hotel Bethlehem in Jesus's day, okay? And when it says no room in the inn, it's not like there's some, you know, heartless Jewish innkeeper who's looking at the keys. Oh, room 5 is taken. Room 8 is full. Oh, there are no rooms in the inn. You know, you'll have to sleep in the stable tonight, poor pregnant woman. This is not what's going on in the story at all. If you look at the story carefully, the word that's translated it comes from the King James Version, for example. That's the word inn. If you look at the Greek word there, the term is actually kataluma, the word that's translated in. The word that Luke uses for in elsewhere is pendokian. So think of the story of the Good Samaritan. He finds the man who's beaten up by the side of the road, and he pays for him to be taken care of in an inn. And of course, there the Jewish innkeeper is very kind, and he's willing to put the man up, and okay, you can pay me whatever else you owe when you come back through town again. The word that's used there is not the same word that's in the story of Jesus' birth. So what is it that is being referred to? Well, like I said, the word that's used, there is no space, I would say. There's no space for them in the room. That's the word. Kataluma actually means room. He was put in the manger because he couldn't be in the room. And that's the same word, kataluma, room, that appears later in the gospel when Jesus celebrates the Last Supper. Where does Jesus celebrate the Last Supper? In the upper room. And Jesus tells the disciples, go into the city and you'll find a room prepared. And it's that same word, kataluma. And so the translation obscures it. People don't see it. But the whole idea is that Jesus put in a manger. What's a manger? It's a feeding trough.
Yeah.
Right? It's where the animals eat out of. It's a box of food, right? Hay, feed, right? Jesus is put where the food goes because he couldn't be in the room. And then later in the story, when he goes into the room, the upper room, what does he do? He says, "This is my body." And so the idea is the infancy of Jesus points forward to the Eucharistic mystery that we read about in the gospel, that Jesus is put in the feeding trough as a substitute for the room, because later when he's in the room, he will explain that he is bread to eat. And the early church fathers all saw this, and I talk about this going all the way back to Origen, right, in the third century. I talk about all of this in the book, but I mean, suffice it to say, they see great significance in this. For example, where is Jesus born? Bethlehem. What does Bethlehem mean? Beth means house. Lehem means bread.
Yes.
Jesus is born in the house of bread, right? So there you see all these converging lines that help us recognize that really Christmas is, in a way, the first Mass, right? Jesus comes to us as food. And every Mass is, in a way, a little Christmas. And so every time we celebrate Mass on Sunday, we sing what the angels sang in Luke's gospel. Glory to God in the excelsis, right? Heaven touched down to earth in Bethlehem on the night Jesus was born, and they sung the song of the angels in the field. And now heaven touches down to earth in the Eucharistic celebration, where Christ comes to us not in a manger, but as heavenly food in the house of bread that Origen says is the church. And so we sing the same song, Glory to God in the Highest.
I just got to tell you.
We can say a lot more about it.
What Dr. Barber just did there, that's what he does in the book. And it's in very accessible, readable chapters. It's the kind of book where, you know, if you put it in the Christmas box, I don't know if you got a box where you keep all your Christmas decorations, you know, that you got at Walmart or wherever. And you put this book in there, and then you stick it on the dining room table by the tree. Each year, your kids will find one chapter of it, maybe, and read it, and they'll be inoculated against so much nonsense about Christmas, and they'll come to love Christmas because they'll come to love Christ. A great book, The True Meaning of Christmas, The Birth of Jesus and the Origins of the Season. If you have questions about the origins of the season, you got questions about Christmas, you got questions about what all of this means, whether you're talking from the scriptural point of view or from what has developed in the church over the last 2,000 years as we celebrate Christmas, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. You certainly don't have to be Catholic or even Christian to call. If you have a question about Christmas, you are welcome here. 888-318-7884.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Are you ready to spread your wings? Wings is the weekly newsletter that's packed with exclusive news, program information, features, and updates of all that's going on at the Global Catholic Network. To sign up, go to EWTN.com, click subscribe, enter your name and email address, and you'll start getting your wings every week. Get your wings today. It's the weekly newsletter from EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Killett, your host. Next hour, Dr. George Delgado will be here. We'll talk about anything you want to talk about. It's a pro-life open forum. Anything pro-life you want to talk about, including today's court case, you're welcome to call second hour. This hour, a delightful book, The True Meaning of Christmas, The Birth of Jesus, and the Origins of the Season. Oh, so many things are said about Christmas. I wonder if you have noticed this. It does seem like every year, for some reason, on the magazine rack, at the checkout, wherever you're checking out, they got to have a Newsweek or a Time, or I mean, I don't even know if they have those magazines, but there's some magazine that's got, you know, why Jesus was secretly a Buddhist, or the truth about Jesus, the hidden truth about the birth of Jesus, you know, it happened in Egypt, or, you know, it's always some new, I'm going to be honest about it, fake controversy. Usually based on the most flimsy stuff. Why do they do that at Christmas? I suppose taking some of the enchantment out of it gives some people pleasure, but you want to put the enchantment back in, and the thing is, the truth is enchanting. Here's a great book for you, The True Meaning of Christmas, The Birth of Jesus, and the Origins of the Season. 888-318-7884, our number. Just before I go back to the callers or anything, Dr. Barber, I wanted to mention you're going to do an actual short course on Christmas for the Augustine Institute.
I am. So if people are interested, you can go to Augustine Institute's website, augustineinstitute.org, and /short courses. We have these great courses. They're very, you know, as it says in the name, short. So it's not a graduate level course. It's a certificate level course. It's about 8 hours. And I'm going to go through the infancy narratives of Jesus. We're going to look at ancient Jewish messianic expectations. But then we also look at the development of the liturgical calendar and how we have the Christmas celebration as we know it today. So that's a lot of fun. That'll be made available very shortly on the Augustine Institute website. So I want to encourage people to stay tuned for that.
And you, of course, are a professor at the Augustine Institute. You teach biblical studies. Is that right?
I am. I'm professor of scripture and theology at the Augustine Institute. People can find me on Twitter if they want to learn more about when those things will be released. I guess that's the best way to know when stuff is going to drop. But anyway, so thanks.
Again, it's all Christmas this hour. If you've got a question about Christmas, Dr. Barber's got an answer for you. 888-318-7884. I'm going to go to Herson, I think, in Texas, listening on 106.9 FM. Did I pronounce your name right?
Yes.
Okay. Herson, go ahead with your...
You pronounce it pretty good. Are you Spanish, sir, or what?
Oh, hablo español, como un mexicano.
Oh, that's awesome.
No, como un gringo.
My friend, no. Hey, I had a question. I just want to know when was the first time, perhaps, that we started calling it Christmas? You know, when? I don't know. Has it always been like that?
Ah, when did that name come into use, Christmas?
Right. Well, it certainly isn't from the Greek. I mean, it certainly isn't Greek, right? Because... it's English, right? So Christ's Mass, it really develops in a period we know as Middle English, okay? So that's going to be, well, I would say between the 11th century and between the, you know, 1000s and the, how should I put it, the 1400s, right? So within that period right there, that's when we have Middle English, and Christmas really comes from that period. I don't have the dead... I don't have the exact date, so I don't know when it, where it first appeared. It certainly developed, you know, and had, you know, took a while to take off, so to speak. But it would be in that Middle English period.
Helping me.
Thanks so much.
I didn't think about the English part.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So really, but yeah, I mean, I would say somewhere between the 1100s and the 1400s would probably be the best way to do it. But I don't know exactly where in that period.
But so does the Spanish word for Christmas, Natividad, does that come from the Latin for nativity?
Yes. Yeah, so the idea is that Christmas is the feast of Christ's, well, we have Christ's Mass. And what is Christ's Mass about? It's about the Mass of Jesus's birth. And so, you know, if you go back and you look at the way the early church celebrated things, they would identify the death of martyrs as their birthday. So, you know, you would have the feast of a particular saint on the day of their death, all right? Well, of course, you already have a feast that celebrates Jesus's death and resurrection and Holy Week. So Christ's Mass comes to be associated with his nativity, with his birth, his actual birth. And in English, it's not Natividad, it's Christmas. That's where it develops.
Got it.
Hassan, out of the liturgy.
Thanks for the call. Thank you very much.
No, thank you for having me. I just have one more thing. What is our guest's name? I wanted to look into his into his books or anything like that.
Yeah.
Any work that he may have done.
Okay, you can find him at the Augustine Institute, but also if you just put in Dr. Michael Barber and Scripture, you'll find him all over the internet. You have a website, Dr. Barber, where you discuss scriptural things that you do with some other scholars.
I do. Yeah, there's a website called thesacredpage.com, and I write on that website with Brant Petrie, John Bergsma, John Kincaid, John Seahorn, Jim Prothrow, other Catholic Bible scholars. So you might want to check out that website. Like I said, you can also find me on Twitter at Michael P. Barber. I'm there. So thanks so much.
I have to be honest with you, too. I was only kidding about speaking Spanish. The words that I spoke in Spanish, that's all the words I know in Spanish.
You had me fooled, Si.
All right, Hassan, thank you very much. And I will wish you an early, even though you're not supposed to do this, a Merry Christmas, just because we're talking about Christmas. I hope you have a Merry Christmas.
Thank you, sir. You guys too.
All right. Thanks very much. 888-318-7884, our number if you want to talk about Christmas. If you got some nagging question about Christmas, you are welcome to call. Maybe you want to know about the wise men. Maybe you want to know about the death of the innocents. Maybe you want to know about the star. As a matter of fact, I do want to know about the star. If you could tell me.
Okay.
And then we'll go back to more calls. Yeah. Tell me about what is that? It seems so astrological, you know, that whole section there.
Right. All right. So people really want to find a way to correlate it to some kind of thing like a planetary conjunction or some kind of comet or something like that. You find that, around today. If you go back to the early church, though, that's not the way they were thinking of it. And there's a real clear reason why. So in the story, what happens? The Magi follow the star to the place where Jesus is born. And they recognize that the star is over the place where Jesus is born. Well, way back in the 300s, John Chrysostom pointed out, this is no ordinary star, right?
Yeah.
Si, if you come out to Colorado and I'm going to give you directions to my house, I'm not going to say, well, you know, look for the, you know, look for a particular, look for Venus.
Yeah.
My house is right underneath that. That should be clear. Right? Okay. You don't need anything else. Don't put away your Waze app or whatever app you use,
yeah.
Your GPS. Just look for Venus and you'll find my house. I mean, nobody would do that, right? And so John Chrysostom made the case, and other early church fathers do as well, that this wasn't any ordinary star. This was probably some kind of appearance of an angelophany. And in fact, today, the angels and stars are still sort of interchangeable. What do you put on the top of your tree? Is
right.
it an angel or a star?
Yeah,
right?
Right.
We still do that. And that's very biblical. If you go and look at the book of Revelation, for example, you see that Jesus is holding in his hand in chapter 1 seven stars, and we're told that the seven stars are seven angels. This is Jewish. Go back to Daniel 12, and you'll see stars and angels are correlated in lots of other places. So that's the way the early church fathers read it. And I think that's the way that makes the most sense of the story, that this was not just like, you know, Jupiter or, you know, Jupiter aligned with Mars or the age of Aquarius or whatever. This was actually an appearance of an angel or the working of an angel, a supernatural sign.
888-318-7884. The number, if you got questions about Christmas, Dr. Barber is here to answer them. I want to tell you the name of the book again. It's called The True Meaning of Christmas, The Birth of Jesus and the Origins of the Season. And it's out now from the Augustine Institute and Ignatius Press. You can get it wherever good Catholic books are sold. You can probably get it. It'll be the exception in this store, but you can get it where bad Catholic books are sold too, probably. And you are welcome. Actually, a lot of folks on the line. I'm going to let you all talk to Dr. Barber. Hang on. A couple lines open. 888-318-7884. Most of us Catholic parents agree our number one goal in life is to pass on the faith to our children. But here's the bad news. Today's world has a million ways to steal your kid's soul. Don't be afraid, says Father Sebastian Walsh. God loves your children even more than you do, and he desires their salvation more than anything. In his groundbreaking new book, Always a Catholic, Father Walsh shows you how to cooperate with God to bring about the fulfillment of his will for your kids. Always a Catholic reminds us that keeping our kids in the faith is about the way we live our Catholicism in our own lives and as a family from day to day. Order your copy of Always a Catholic by visiting shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. It's free, and you'll have instant access to our daily broadcast, the schedule of upcoming shows, and you'll even be able to search the archive and listen to thousands of past shows. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. All right, I said I'm going to go right to the callers, and I am, but I just found out something so cool about this book. I didn't mention. I said this is a beautiful book, and it's a hardcover book, and it's one that I was suggesting you could just put in your Christmas box and take out every year, leave it on the coffee table, and people will find out about Jesus and the love of God and all that. They'll get some Christmas myths debunked. But then Dr. Barber said, hey, take off the cover and look at it. It's embossed. It's a beautiful embossed cover underneath the dust cover. This is a beautiful book that they published for you.
They really did a very nice job. And we want to get it out there for people to give away as gifts, not just for themselves. I mean, this is the time of year where people are really interested in talking about the Bible. And so there aren't a lot of times of the year where you can give someone a book that talks about the story of Jesus. But this is a time of year that really makes sense to do that. And so we wanted to help people be able to give something away.
It's called The True Meaning of Christmas, The Birth of Jesus and the Origins of the Season. A beautiful gift, a beautiful thing for families to have and to keep for years. I'm going to go to Cincinnati now, the possible future home of the national champion, Cincinnati Bearcats. Julian, listening on 740 AM, you are up next. Julian, go ahead with your question for Dr. Barber.
Thank you. And so I have a question about the origin of Christmas. And some things doesn't make sense to me. Isn't we hear that Christmas was the rebirth of the sun on December 25th, and then it was Christianized to make it be the birth of Jesus, because when we look at the Christmas time, the story of Christmas talks about where the shepherds were in the fields. It sounds like it's winter time. Why would shepherds be in the fields during winter time? And wasn't Jesus born maybe sometime around September, as opposed to Christmas when it's considered the birth of the sun because of the, you know, all the things that...
Julian, let's let Dr. Barber answer those, and I'll come back and see if the answers satisfy you, because it's getting to be a long list. But I do want to hear the answers to that. What about that, the birth of the sun?
A lot there. Yeah, there's a lot there. And actually, this was the chapter of the book that I spent the longest writing, because there is a lot of unreliable information out there. I draw from the latest peer-reviewed scholarly journals, and you can see that in some of the footnotes. But this was actually the chapter I had the most fun writing because, again, it is a complex issue. But let's just say a couple of things. So first of all, you pointed out that the shepherds were in the field, and so therefore Jesus wouldn't have been born in the winter. And I will recognize that I think the fact that the shepherds are in the field, that makes it less likely that it's winter time, according to Luke. That being said, it should be pointed out that there are Jewish sources that indicate that Passover lambs would be grazing in February, which would be winter time. So it's not completely impossible that there would be shepherds in the field in the winter. Okay, so I think you've got to be careful about hanging too much on that. It is clear that there was no obvious tradition that was passed down from the early Christians about when Jesus was born. So when we have the early writings of Clement of Alexandria, he's talking about the fact, this is in the 200s, he's talking about the fact that lots of people are curious as to when Jesus was born, and nobody really knows. And he gives dates that go all over the calendar as, well, these are the ones that have been suggested. By the way, December 25th isn't among the dates that are suggested at his time. And in fact, we know that the early Christians in Bethlehem, and you'd expect, you know, they would maybe be the ones to preserve the tradition, right, of when Jesus was born. They certainly preserved a tradition of where Jesus was born. But the early Christians in Bethlehem were celebrating Jesus' birth in January, not in December. So there was no obvious, clear apostolic tradition that was passed on about when was Jesus born. Now, some people will say what you said, and that is, well, Christmas was originally a religious pagan holiday. And I talk about that at length in the book. What was often said is that there was an emperor named Aurelian, and in 274, he elevated the worship of a sun god known as Sol Invictus. And we know that Sol Invictus was worshipped on December 25th. And so people say, ah, so they must have got the idea of Christmas from the idea that there's a sun god who's already got a feast day on December 25th. But the problem for that, the problem with that is, we don't have any evidence, we don't have any written sources that tell us that Sol Invictus was worshipped on December 25th until you get into the 4th century. And the interesting thing is the same document, that's the first document that tells us that Sol Invictus was worshipped on December 25th, this Roman sun god, Sol Invictus, the unconquered sun, Sol means sun. Right. The first document that tells us about Sol Invictus being worshipped on December 25th isn't from the time of Aurelian. It's from the 4th century. And that very same document is the first undisputed reference to Jesus's birth being on December 25th. And so it's also possible that the pagans decided to worship their sun god on December 25th. Because they, you know, knew that Christians were already worshiping on that day. So it's a little bit complicated. But what we will say is this, and I think that this is very, the idea that Jesus was born in September, we don't know that Jesus was born in September. That is based on speculation, and I could get into the argument. I know the arguments and the people who make them. But suffice it to say, it doesn't hold up under close scrutiny. Again, you can read my book to get to all this. But suffice it to say, we do know that they end up, the early Christians do end up marking Jesus's birth on the feast of the winter solstice. That's December 25th on the old Roman calendar, what's known as the Julian calendar, the calendar associated with Julius Caesar. And the winter solstice was a cosmic day. It was a really important day, right? In the ancient world, they didn't have electrical lighting. So everybody was keenly aware of how much daylight you had at a given time of the year. And today we'll go outside and say, wow, I can't believe it's dark so early, right? But they wouldn't have that experience in the ancient world because they knew that, you know, there was a cycle here because it was, you know, they were farming and it was really significant to their daily life. And so what they ended up doing is they recognized that on December 25th, the sunlight begins to grow. And that has great cosmic significance. And what the Christians wanted to say is the cosmos, the universe, is ultimately about Jesus. And the book of Malachi contains a prophecy that refers to the Son of Righteousness. And early church fathers said, well, that's ultimately a reference to Jesus. He is the Son of Righteousness. And we have Christmas songs today. Hail the Son of Righteousness. That's from that passage in Malachi. Right, exactly. And the idea was Jesus is the true Son. The creation is ultimately fulfilled in Jesus. So Christians decided to worship on that day, and they knew that it could be controversial, and it did create some controversy. And I talk about things that, for example, Pope Leo the Great talks about in his sermons, where people are confused about sun worship and the birth of Jesus. And I don't have time to get into all of that, but suffice it to say, the church decided to pick a day of cosmic significance to worship Jesus, but to say it was originally the day on which the Romans worship the sun god, Sol Invictus, in particular, that gets bandied about quite a bit, but it may not have as much historical merit as people think it does.
All right, Julian.
Does that help?
What do you think, Julian?
Yeah, I think it's good. Thanks.
Okay, very good. Thank you very, very much for the call.
All right, thanks.
I'm super glad we got to do that one, because you do hear often these things are said as if they're just absolutely set in stone. And that I had never heard that about the... You said it was a 4th century document, so this is already a time when Christianity is legal in the empire and maybe even has become the religion of the empire, depending on when it is in the 4th century. And
right.
And so you have Christianity everywhere. So which came first, yeah. Sol Invictus or the Nativity of Jesus? We don't know.
We really don't know, and it could be that they wanted to draw people away from Christianity and put the feast on that day. We don't know for sure. But one thing that's really fascinating, Cy, and I talk about this in the book, is that there is a manuscript of a commentary on Daniel that is attributed to the early Christian writer Hippolytus. And in that commentary on Daniel, in this manuscript, it says Jesus's birth is on December 25th. Now, if that was part of the original document, that would have been in the 200s. So that'd be long before we have evidence for Sol Invictus. Now, it's debated whether or not that line was originally part of the manuscript or if it was added later. I talk about this a little bit in the book. But there are reasons to think there was another guy named Julius Africanus, and he believed that Jesus was conceived on March 25th. Well, if he's conceived on March 25th, guess when Julius Africanus thought Jesus was born? Right? In December, right?
Right.
And 9 months exactly would be December 25th. And so there's good reason to think that the idea of Christmas being December 25th may be earlier than we have absolute certainty from not absolute, but good certainty from manuscript evidence. But anyway,
fascinating.
It's all fascinating to me. That's why I put it in the book.
Yeah, and it is a fascinating book. The True Meaning of Christmas, The Birth of Jesus and the Origins of the Season. All kinds of issues, just as we've just been discussing with Julian, covered in the book. Hey, if you're on the line, hang on. I got to take a quick break. We're going to get to you callers. There are a few lines open. So if you have a question about Christmas, maybe you want to know about the origins of the Christmas tree. Whatever you'd like to know, give a call, 888-318-7884.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Want the latest pro-life news? Want it delivered? Sign up. It's free. EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, your source for everything happening now in the fight to protect the sanctity of human life. New episodes delivered every week to your inbox. So if you really want to know,
sign up today.
Go to EWTN.com/pro-life today.
Before I left today, Carrie told me, do this ad and do a really good job on it because it's important. And then I was having so much fun talking to Dr. Barbara, I never did this ad. So I have to read it. Okay. Right. Is my microphone on, Zach? All right, here we go. How do you get the best Catholic Christmas sale on the internet and make it better? How about an extra 25% off already discounted prices? How about free shipping? How about you get on over to shop.catholic.com where we're launching December Deal Days, a great way to load up on great deals and make it easier on your pocketbook. We've got hundreds of great Catholic resources and all of them are already on sale. And now, when you enter the promo code MYDEAL, M-Y-D-E-A-L, at checkout, you save an extra 25% off, plus we'll give you free shipping on orders over $50. What are you waiting for? Get on over to shop.catholic.com. There were so many extra 25% in that ad. I don't know if you're paying anything now. I mean, see, it just seemed like they kept taking 25% off, and now you might. It seems conceivable to me that you're not paying anything for these. Maybe not. I mean, I'm not good at math. 888-318-7884, our number, 888-318-7884. Dr. Michael Barber, our guest. The book, The True Meaning of Christmas, The Birth of Jesus, and the Origins of the Season. It's got all that Christmas joy that you want and a little bit of intellectual heft, too, to talk about some of these, challenges that are made to Christmas and that kind of thing, as you just heard from Julian from Cincinnati. We'll go now to Tom in Omaha. Hi, Tom, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Barber.
There is, in common language, at least four different names for the manger scene: crib, creche, nativity, manger scene, and there may be a couple of others. What would be the most appropriate word to describe that?
Oh.
Right. I mean, I think that crutch is just from the French word, is just a French word for manger, right? So we're just saying manger in different ways. I will say just my own personal preference there. I can't dictate, you know, what should be normative, but my own personal preference is to talk about the manger, because the more we emphasize that Christ comes to us as food, the more clearly we can see the implications for understanding the Eucharist, right? So I like to use manger and explain what that is, but there isn't a wrong one. I guess there could be, but not of the ones that I have just heard.
Okay, Tom.
Thanks for your question, though.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That manger thing is really related to the idea that you want to not lose the very strong biblical idea of Jesus as food.
Mm-hmm.
Is that it?
Yep. That's exactly right.
All right. Let's see who else we got on the line. We'll go to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, I'm going to Tulsa, Oklahoma this weekend. Listening on Oklahoma Catholic Radio, William in Tulsa. Maybe I'll see you there, William. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Barber.
Hey, where are you going to be in Tulsa?
At the cathedral, and we're doing the big fundraiser for St. Michael Catholic Radio.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, David Niles and them. Awesome.
Yeah, Adam Minahan, David Niles, the Catholic Man Show.
Yep, maybe I'll see you there.
I hope so.
So my question is about the ranking of the Feast of Christmas. So obviously Easter and Pentecost historically are really important. And then, like, in the Eastern Church, you've got Epiphany being super important, and then, like, the Transfiguration. So, like, historically, where does Christmas fit in among the other big feasts?
Right. So, certainly, Easter is very important early on. And Epiphany becomes a much bigger feast, really worldwide, after the date of Christmas really, you know, is established for a universal church, right? But already very early on, and people will be surprised by this, so I put it at the very beginning of my book, John Chrysostom in the 300s said that the birth of Jesus is the Feast of the Nativity is, quote, the chief and mother of all holy days. So already in the 300s, Chrysostom is saying that. Now, he had to sell it to the people in the East because it wasn't really a major day. He was trying to get people to fast for Christmas. Now, we wouldn't really think of doing that now, but he was trying to get people to take the birth of Jesus more seriously because it marked such a momentous event in salvation history, God coming to us in the flesh. So it kind of depends where you go, East, West, Rome, Spain, you know, France, Jerusalem. It sort of evolves over time, but certainly Easter is the most important. Holy Week is the most important. But already by the 300s, we're seeing a lot of emphasis given to Christmas and given to it as not as the most important day of the year, although, again, John Chrysostom uses this expression that is sort of breathtaking, actually. So hope that helps.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, William. Appreciate the call. Several more calls to get to, so I'm going to try to keep moving to get everybody on. We're talking about Christmas with Michael Barber, the author of The True Meaning of Christmas, The Birth of Jesus, and the Origins of the Season. Let's go to Colorado. Stephen, listening on 1060 AM in Colorado. Stephen, are you there with us?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yep. I interrupted you. I apologize. Go ahead.
That's okay. I have a fairly simple question. I've been reading the Nativity with my children a lot, and the story says that the shepherds, when they return to the field, that they return with their sheep. And my question is, did the shepherds actually have all of the sheep with them when they visited Jesus at his Nativity?
Right. There's so much there with that story. And, you know, people like to read a lot into it that, well, these were the sheep that were going to be sacrificed on Passover. We don't know that. So people also say, well, the shepherds were unclean in Jesus's day. Jews didn't. Yeah, you listen to some people, and Jews don't like anybody. Jews don't like women. Jews don't like. It's really frustrating because it's latent anti-Semitism, really, from the. And in many ways, the 19th century and going forward, especially in Germany, where, you know, again, the story of the Nativity is, some heartless innkeeper sent this pregnant woman out into the night,
yeah,
into a cold night, and forced her to give birth. And what is it? It's, of course, a Jewish innkeeper, right? So you get all these sort of ridiculous stereotypes of oh, yeah, it's
yeah.
awful. It's awful. In order to elevate Jesus, we don't have to denigrate Jews. We don't have to do that. That's not necessary. Anyway, I just wanted to say that because it's so often kind of underlying the way people interpret the story of Jesus's birth. Of course, in the story of Jesus's birth, we read that the shepherds were in the field keeping watch over their flock. Then the angels come and announce the birth of Jesus, and we read, the shepherds said to one another, let us go over to Bethlehem see this thing that has happened. So they went with haste, and they found Mary. And then the shepherds returned praising God. So if we read the story carefully, it never tells us, and this is always frustrating, never tells us what they did with their sheep. Did they leave their sheep behind? In some ways, that wouldn't be surprising because it's in Luke's gospel that we read the story of the good shepherd who leaves the 99, right, for the one sheep. So there's that. But also remember that shepherds could have put their sheep in a pen. They could have they could have put them in a place where they would have been safe and then gone off to visit the child, right? So they had to let the sheep out to graze, but they certainly could put the sheep in a safe place and then go visit the child and then come back. It's not really that far away. I've been there to the traditional site of the shepherd's field where the Church of the Nativity is. It's really not that far. So it doesn't say they brought their sheep with them, and I am disinclined to think that they did. So I know it makes for a less colorful depiction of the Nativity because people want to have all these sheep and all these animals and everything, but it probably didn't happen quite that way.
What do you think,
Hope
Steve?
Hope that helps.
I thank you very much. Yeah, that answers the question. I just thought, wow, what an amazing scene would have been if all these sheep would have been
there.
I don't know. I was just so curious.
It would look great visually, and it would be great for a movie, but we're not told that they took the sheep, and I think it would be impractical for them to do so. So I think the natural reading of the story is to assume that the author expects his readers to understand that the shepherds would have taken care of their sheep and then gone over to the birth of Jesus. I mean, they went with haste, but it doesn't say that they just abandoned their sheep to the hillside or that they drove them all to the place where Jesus was born, which might have been pretty difficult. So,
I think
they probably went by themselves.
As a great biblical scholar, I'd like to just point out the one option that you're leaving out, that they left him with the angels. The angels were like, we'll watch the sheep. You go see the baby Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah, but it says that the angels went away from them. So
I'm not the great biblical scholar, I thought. All right, let's try to get Elsie in. Thanks, Stephen, very much. Elsie, also in Colorado, also listening on 1060 AM. Elsie, go ahead with your question for Dr. Barber.
Hi there. I just wanted to know, in the depictions of the nativity and stuff, sometimes, or a lot of most of the times, you see the baby Jesus in the manger, right? But in some movies, when the Magi come to see him, he's like grown already.
Yeah.
So I'm like, wow, what did he, you know, did he sprout up real quick or what is that, you know?
How old was Jesus when the Magi came?
Right, that's a fantastic question. And as you might expect, I talk about this in my book. So one of the things that's really interesting is that we know that when the Magi come, Herod has all the children in Bethlehem killed who are 2 years and younger, and that he diligently inquired from these Magi about how long ago it had been since they saw the star. And so it seems likely that the coming of the Magi is some period after Jesus's birth. In fact, Luke doesn't use the term that's used for infants. I'm sorry, Matthew doesn't use the same term that's used for infants when he describes the children in when he describes Jesus's the child Jesus in the story of the Magi coming. So it's very likely the case that Jesus had grown up. It could have been up to 2 years after Jesus's birth. Does that help, Elsie?
Yes, it does. It does. Thank you. I thought it might be, and then I thought, well, no, maybe I'm wrong. I better ask somebody. So,
well, you asked the right guy.
Time for me to ask. Yeah.
Yeah. So in Luke's gospel, Jesus is called an infant. Brephos is the Greek word that's used there. But as I explain in the book, in Matthew, when the Magi come, he's a paideon. And that can refer to a child 8 days old, but as old as 7 years of age. So he's a little older when the Magi came. We know that.
Elsie, thanks for the call and for the question. Thanks to everybody who called. Next hour, Dr. George Delgado will be here. We'll do a pro-life open forum. Our guest this hour has been Dr. Michael Barber of the Augustine Institute in Colorado. Get the new book, The True Meaning of Christmas, The Birth of Jesus and the Origins of the Season. Leave it around. People will find it, they'll pick it up, and they will be closer to Jesus, and they'll know more about Christmas, and they'll be happier for it. Thanks, Dr. Barber.
Thank you very much.
All right, right back with Dr. George Delgado.